the trick, said Bexoy, gasping, is to heat all the body except the head, so that you can remain conscious through the entire process of burning alive. Bexoy was hurrying, heating her body quickly, trying to distract Anonoe from her probe. And it was working, Anonoe knew, because it grew harder to concentrate on her outself. Her inself was screaming, I'm going to die! In that moment of desperation, she thought of Set, the man-mage who never dies, because his ka is free of any flesh. But that's because he has never fully bonded with a body. I have. This body, this burning body. Flames erupted from her skin, but she could still see. Her muscles still, for this moment, responded to her will. So she leapt forward, threw her arms around Bexoy, embraced her. Don't you know that I can keep the fire from touching me? Said Bexoy scornfully. Now die, whore! The sudden surge of heat destroyed Anonoe's whole body in an instant. But in that instant, Anonoe followed the road she had found into Bexoy's mind, and then on into her body. I am not dead yet, she thought. But, lacking a mouth, could not say, I am here in you, Queen Bexoy, not as a visitor, not as a beast mage partnering with his heart beast. I am here as a ka that knows how to fully possess a body of flesh and bone. Anonoe felt the cool skin of the new body, the queen's body. Suddenly she could see again, through Bexoy's eyes, because they were now Anonoe's eyes. She willed herself to move, and she moved. Moved, and in the movement became the master of this body. She could still feel Bexoy inside her, struggling to control the body, failing, failing. Anonoe's dead body was still brilliantly hot, and the bones, not yet crumbled, still held it up. The arms were still wrapped around Bexoy, but Anonoe had no skill as a fire mage and did not know how to control it. Nor did Bexoy have access to the body's ability to command the fire. So the heat of the fire suddenly passed the boundary between the charred corpse of Anonoe and became an agony of burning flesh in Bexoy's body, whose pain both women felt. Anonoe screamed and thrust the burning mass away, but too late. Bexoy's own clothing had been charred in the instant, and the skin of this unfamiliar new body was burning. Anonoe had no knowledge of how to put the fire out. Bexoy knew, but if Anonoe let her have enough control to block the flame, Bexoy's strong ka would take her body back. Either die now by being thrust out of this body by its evil owner, or die later from these agonizing burns. Nobody could burn like this and live. I will have died twice by fire, Bexoy only the once. But then, she thought, fall to the floor, smother the fire. It worked to put the fire out, but it restored nothing. Her flesh was charred. Her bodily fluids were flowing out of the entire front of her ruined body. The pain was so agonizing that Anonoe knew she would faint. But she could not faint. If she did, Bexoy could take her body back. Then, to Anonoe's surprise, she felt something else. Bexoy's inself was retreating, fading, ceasing to reach into every corner of this half-burnt body. It had never occurred to Anonoe that Bexoy might surrender. It had to be a trick. No, not a trick. It was death. Bexoy's body, the ape her ka had once controlled, was dying, and Bexoy knew it, not intellectually, but deep in the core of her being. It was time to shed the body and move on. Bexoy was no man-mage. She did not know how to attach herself to a body and hold on. But Anonoe did. I will be alone in here. For a moment, that felt like triumph. In the next moment, she realized it was failure. Only if Bexoy's ka remained in this body was there any hope of having access to her fire magery, not to mention her role as queen, the love of Priard, and the baby. The baby, thought Anonoe. The baby, she screamed inside her mind. If Bexoy heard the thought, she did not respond. She continued receding, dying. Stay! It was Anonoe's will, her demand that Bexoy refuse to die. Here, thought Anonoe, I give you a place to remain. Here are the hands and feet, here is the mouth, the eyes, the groin, the belly with a baby in it. See? I invite you back. No, I will not leave to make room for you. There is room for both. We can both control this flesh, this tortured and dying flesh. Only half understanding what she was doing, Anonoe drew Bexoy's ka more firmly and fully into the dying flesh. You will stay through all of it, thought Anonoe. Just as you were going to make me stay conscious until I burned to death, you will stay here in this body until it dies. But Anonoe knew that was not what she meant at all, for she had not despaired. To her, this body was not dead, was not going to die. For the flake of Ba that she had put in Wad was still there, still calling, still demanding that he come. And if he came soon enough, if he came now, he could still pass her through a gate and save this flesh, save even the baby. That was when she felt the vibration in the floor. Someone standing there. No door had opened, no one had heard the talking or the shouting, or if they heard, they didn't want to intrude. So only one man in all the world could be standing here, though Anonoe had no power to raise her head, no voice with which to speak, no strength to move. You killed her, and then you burned for it. Justice. Wad's voice was quiet. She could feel the grief and rage. Everything I love you take from me. So he did love her. It was not just any bed when the need comes on. And then she realized. He is talking to this dying body on the floor as if it were Bexoy, and only Bexoy. He has no intention of healing her. He is going to watch her die. Save her! Anonoe shouted through the bit of her ba that dwelt in Wad's mind. She did not try to control him. She did not dare use more than this small bit of her attention, lest the distraction give Bexoy a chance to either slip away entirely and die, or to wrest control of her body back again. She could feel Wad's torment as he wrestled against the impulse she was sending him. I am Anonoe! Yet, how could her wordless ba make such a strange thought clear in Wad's mind? The ba dealt only in emotions and kinetic memories. It was emotion, not identity, that she needed to send into him. All her love for him. The trouble was that she did not love him. Not so very much. Enough, yes, to share his bed. But he was also the torturer who had damaged her children. She had managed to thrust her rage into another compartment in her mind, to save it for another time, when it might more usefully be expressed. But it meant that she could not thrust into Wad her love for him because there wasn't enough of it. Nor could she control him enough to remind him of his love for her, because she knew that he did not love her so very much either. But she loved her children, and she knew that he had loved his own child. And there was a living child, still for one moment more, in the belly of this woman. A child who did not deserve to die, whatever the mother might have done. Love of a child. Anonoe's love for Eliuic and Anop. She also reached for his own memories of holding his son, Trick, of playing with him, talking to him. Anonoe had no idea what Wad had said to his son, but she knew that he had talked to him, and she could touch those memories and rekindle them. And she could make him think of the belly of the dying woman lying on the floor of Kiel's office. She felt his decision at the very moment he passed a gate over her body. For it was hers now, as surely as it was Bexoy's. The gate did not drive her out of the body, nor was Bexoy any longer trying to die. It's the baby that I'm saving, not you, said Wad.
To her? Of course not. To Bexoy. I'm a Nonoe, she said.
But no sound came out.
Nothing.
For Bexoy's ka was fully in this body, and so was Anonoe's, and Bexoy would not let the body act on Anonoe's intention to identify herself as present in this flesh. Bexoy wanted her gone. Sole control of this body, that's all that she would settle for. I should have let her die. But if I had, would I have been able to keep the flesh alive? Do I still need Bexoy to maintain my life? It doesn't matter whether I do or not. She's here, and the opportunity to let her die is gone now that the body is healed. Does she choose to block me from speech? Then I choose to block her.
A simple thank you would do, said Wad, or even a curse. I have no fear of your curses. Or are you trying to work up the strength to burn me to death the way you burned Anonoe? She was worth 10 of you, you know. A better mother than you, and not just because she never arranged for the murder of her firstborn. Burn me if you can. See what happens.
And then he wept. Maybe Anonoe loved this man more than she had supposed. Anonoe wanted to look at him, to use these eyes to see him, these hands to reach for him. But Bexoy blocked her. The weeping stopped. Wad spoke again, whispered.
You knew that I couldn't kill your baby, even though you killed mine. You knew there was a line I wouldn't cross. But once the baby is born, anyone can nurse it. Do you understand?
Anonoe understood, and so did Bexoy. If they did not manage to end their struggle and find a way to make this body speak aloud, then after the birth of the baby, she would die. They would die. But there was still a little while before the baby was due.
Wad rolled the body over so it was lying on its back. He pried open an eyelid. The reflex for the eye to focus was under the control of the ape brain, not the two kas that warred within it. So Anonoe saw, and therefore remembered, that Kiel still hung, alive, from the rafter overhead. Look up, she said to Wad. And then she filled him with the kinetic memory of looking up. And so he looked.
Kiel, he said.
In a moment, he had gated himself to the rafter, and the open eye watched as Wad untied the man, as he caught Kiel in a gate, so he landed on the floor after the fall of half an inch, rather than 10 feet.
I am not utterly helpless in this flesh, thought Anonoe. I am still a man-mage. I can keep communicating with the portion of my ba that already dwells in him. There were other splinters of her outself that connected her to Eliuik and Anop, and to the couple in Middleguard who were looking after them. Her connection with the Gatefather Danny North, with Bexoy's nephew Frostinch, with King Priard, all these persisted, along with her links with the enemies of Bexoy. Bexoy would probably be able to block her from making new connections, but she could not interfere with the ones that still existed from before. They were part of Anonoe's self, her ka and ba, and Bexoy had no part in them. So while Bexoy was fully trapped inside this stalemated, unmoving body, Anonoe could still influence the actions of dozens of people, could still reshape events, at least a little. That's a tiny bit of justice on my side.
Chapter 23 Resolution Wad listened as Kiel told him how Queen Bexoy and two soldiers arrested him and brought him to his office and hung him from the rafter. There was no explanation, no threat. Kiel had kept quiet, expecting her to ask him questions, to accuse him of something. But not a word was said until Anonoe arrived.
It was hard for me to concentrate on what they were saying, said Kiel. The queen called Anonoe a man-mage, which is true enough. I don't think the queen knew that the man-mage who was interfering with people like me was Anonoe until she appeared here. Bexoy said she had studied man-magery because man-mages and gate-mages were the only ones who posed a threat to her. Bexoy kept waiting for you to come. I think she was using Anonoe as bait.
I was busy, said Wad. I didn't realize that Anonoe was calling me until too late.
Bexoy is a fire mage.
I know, said Wad.
The way she burned up Anonoe, it was...
Apparently there was no word in his mind for what it was. Keel broke into convulsive sobs.
I thought I was going to die.
Why was Bexoy burned as well? Her fires never harmed her before.
Anonoe threw herself on her at the last moment and held her close, said Keel. That's how it looked to me, at least.
That shouldn't have made any difference, said Wad.
Bexoy could stand in a furnace that would melt granite and the heat would never reach her.
Then Bexoy must not have burned, said Keel.
Getting some sarcasm back, I see, said Wad.
You're the kitchen boy. Hull's errand runner.
I am, said Wad. And you've been a gate mage the whole time.
It made me a better errand runner, said Wad.
Why hasn't the gate thief eaten your gates? Asked Keel.
Do you really want even more of the kind of information that will make me need to kill you? Asked Wad.
If you didn't kill Queen Bexoy when you had her in your power, you won't kill me, said Keel.
You don't know what I'll do, said Wad.
I know that if you're Queen Bexoy's friend after all, I'll kill you if I ever get the chance.
I'm not her friend, said Wad.
She told Anonoe that the gate mage was once her lover. Was that you?
I put a baby in that belly once, said Wad.
The boy that she named Oath was mine.
Keel's body shook again, but now with laughter.
Poor Priard! Cuckolded by a kitchen boy!
By a spy that he often resorted to himself.
So? He knows you, said Keel.
And trusted me, once upon a time. The question now is, what should I do with you?
I'm now the open enemy of the queen, known to her. If she lives, my life is as good as gone. I don't know why she isn't killing us both right now, but even if she chooses to bide her time, I'm a dead man. I doubt there's anywhere that I can flee where she won't follow or send an assassin after me. So I will do whatever I can to kill her. Does that make us allies or enemies?
Not until her baby is born, said Wad.
Keel nodded.
Yes, you told her that. You spared her for the baby's sake.
And so will you.
Keel nodded.
Unless she comes after me, I will defend myself.
Whatever is keeping her silent, said Wad, does not make her deaf. I think she hears us and she understands, even if she can't give us a sign of it. Maybe pride alone holds her tongue. But I tell her now, in front of you, that if she harms you in any way, or Anonoe's children, I'll overcome my scruples about not killing her unborn child.
Thank you, said Keel.
I can't understand why I don't feel any pain. I hung there for hours.
Passing through a gate restores your body to perfect health, maintaining the age and shape that you've achieved.
I didn't know that, said Keel. So gate mages are all healers.
Yes, I think I had some vague knowledge of that. Old stories.
Keel, I need your help.
I doubt you want a ship. You who can travel anywhere in the blink of an eye.
I have the body of the queen apparently in some kind of trance, but she's in your private office. Surely this is not where she should be discovered.
Keel thought for a moment.
Can you take her back to her own rooms in Nasasa?
And let her simply be discovered? The problem is that her clothes are half burnt away. No woman in my house has clothing fit for a queen.
Then I think our purpose will be best served if she is found in some strange place, without clothing. She needs to be discovered quickly, because in this weather she would soon die of exposure.
You want me to discover her?
Tell me a place where you or a workman would find her, but where you would not be suspected of having put her.
In the water, said Kiel. If she bobs to the surface where fishermen are passing on their way home, then she'll be found. Found naked in the river, no one will know where she might have been thrown in.
Should we bind her hands and feet? Asked Wad.
No, said Kiel. No one would believe that she hadn't drowned. Better to have it thought that she was struggling to swim and then fell victim to the cold.
And the cold would explain this coma, if it persists. There's always the risk that the moment she's not in my direct control, she'll start to speak. I'll keep a watch on her. If she starts to talk to anyone, I'll warn you. I'll gate you wherever you want, you and anyone you want to take with you.
So much simpler just to kill her, said Kiel.
For a man who was almost the victim of assassination yourself, you're awfully bloodthirsty.
You don't understand, said Kiel. She murdered Anonoe, a woman I honored and admired and obeyed. Even if Anonoe, as a man-mage, put these feelings in my heart, that doesn't make them any less real. The murder was terrible. I will not let this monster live. If I'm in exile, I won't be in a place where I can kill her.
If she starts to talk, said Wad, I'll bring you to her with a knife in your hand.
I wish I had realized years ago that you were something more than the palace monkey, said Kiel.
But if you had realized it, said Wad, would I have let you live to reach this happy day?
This happy day, said Kiel bitterly. He moved to the burned clothing, the ashy corpse of Anonoe, and knelt. She used me, but in a way that I was happy to be used. If she was compelling me, it was to do what I would have done by choice, though with less boldness, work against the queen.
May I take these ashes and these clothes, and give them a proper deeping in the river? As long as no one knows whom you're deeping, then I would also like her to have such honor. I did her great harm once upon a time. Now I can never redress that wrong. But her sons are still in my keeping, and my own way to honor her will be to keep them safe and whole, and help them reach a happy life if they choose it.
Are we friends, then? Asked Kiel. I don't know what I can offer such a mage as you. My powers are not worth mentioning compared to yours.
It's not the magery that makes the man, but what he does with it, and with any other opportunity that he is given, said Wad.
You say that as if it were an old saying, but I've never heard it.
I learned it in my childhood, more than 14 centuries ago, and in another language.
Kiel took in this information calmly.
There are tales in this that someday I'd like to hear. How a man can live so long. How you kept your gates when the gate thief took everybody else's. What harm you did in Onoe. And how you came to be the lover of the queen.
What parts I could tell you, you would not believe. And what you would believe, I dare not tell you, said Wad. But I know the service you have done for Iceway. And if it comes to war with Grey, I know that Iceway will have a mighty fleet, only because of your brilliant and devious mind. That's what you bring to our alliance. Your loyalty, your love of country, your intelligence, your resourcefulness, and a deep goodness that Anonoe admired.
Again a sob caught at Kiel's throat, but then he mastered it.
Few will know, except for you and me, the greatness of Anonoe's heart, and how faithfully she served King Priard and the people of Iceway.
Everyone will know, if one of her sons someday inherits this kingdom, said Wad. But now it's time for you to place yourself where the fishermen who find Queen Bexoy in the river will come directly to you. Tell me where you want to be, and I can put you there. Or you can go yourself so that the ordinary witnesses will believe that you were there on business, and it was only chance that made you the official into whose hands the fishermen delivered the half-drowned body of the queen.
Kiel told him a place on the docks where he had a team of workmen refitting a ship for a long voyage.
"I'll be there in 10 minutes," he said. "And I have work enough to keep me there for another 10.
"Make sure there's a likely fishing vessel coming in or going out," said Wad. "The Queen will bump against the side of it."
"There's always at least one fishing boat, and usually a dozen, within hail of the docks."
"Then gather up Anonoway's remains," said Wad, "while I undress the Queen."
It took Kiel very little time to gather the sad ashes of Anonoway, along with her half-charred clothing, and put them in a pot that previously held nuts, which now were strewn on his writing table. Wad did not remove the last of Bexway's undergarments until the man was gone. She was the Queen, after all, and once he had loved her. With his hands on her unresponsive body, with the warmth of her flesh under his fingers, old feelings came flooding back. He had loved her with the intensity of a boy's first love, for she was his first love after the long amnesia of the tree, and when it began he was a boy again, though old memories came back quickly enough, along with his knowledge of how a woman might be pleased. By habit, he found his fingers stroking her as if in lovemaking, but he caught himself and stopped. She was no longer the woman he had been besotted with. Now she was the murderer of their son, the boy whom she called oath and he called trick, and he did not love her. Yet those feelings were so strong within him that he could hardly drive them away. He had to stand up and pace the room until he judged that Kiel had been gone for long enough that it was worth checking on his progress. Yes, he was at the dock, and already heavily engaged in conversation with the foreman and a couple of workmen. Wad looked out across the water and chose the ship, an inbound vessel with a crew that seemed alert enough, as with long sweeps of two oars on a side, they rowed upstream.
"Don't inhale," he told Queen Bexoy, "and you'll be fine. Or if you can't control your body well enough to manage that, I'm sure the fishermen will be able to revive you. Trust me. After saving you from the ravages of fire, I will not let you drown or freeze to death. Whatever the sailors do to revive and warm you, I can promise it will work."
Then he guided her into the water, just below the surface, so she would bob up between the portside oars. He watched them notice her, drag her into the boat. He was glad to see that she was capable of choking and sputtering and struggling to breathe. It meant she wasn't paralyzed. But when the sailors peppered her with questions, she said nothing. And so they took her into shore, where Kiel performed his show of recognizing her, modestly covering her, and taking her to Nasasa, where King Priard rewarded the sailors, and Kiel as well, for bringing his wife and unborn baby home to him. Then Wad watched as Danny North sent all the other mages of Middleguard to Westall, making sure they immediately went back again. The boy learned well. He was careful. If Wad was fated to lose his gates to a greater gatefather, then fate was kind to let it be a responsible, intelligent, persuasible lad like Danny North. Throughout the day, Wad checked on Bexoy many times, but she never spoke or did anything that seemed volitional, though she breathed and took in food when it was given to her. If she was putting on an act, she was astonishingly consistent. Someone less clever would have feigned a coma, and then it would have been easy to discover that she was really awake. By pretending this sort of catatonia, her eyes could be left open by someone else so she might see. Her breathing could show responses to what went on around her without provoking suspicion that she was faking all of it. There was also the possibility that it was real, though with Bexoy, to have something really be exactly what it seemed was so unlikely. At last, late in the day, Wad allowed himself the luxury of sleep. He was wakened by an urgent stirring of his outself. It was the gates that he had given to Danny North. They no longer obeyed him, but they were still part of him, and their agitation, their panic, filled him with fear as well. Immediately he tried to make sense of what they were perceiving from Danny's mind. The boy thought he was dreaming, but he was not dreaming. There was a woman in his bed, a woman that he did not love and did not want. He knew that he did not want her, and yet his body wanted her, and so he continued to believe it was a dream, or to pretend to himself that he believed it. But it was this very dream state that had alerted Wad's outself to the danger, for Wad had seen possession many times, and his Ba remembered it. A dozen of the Sudahites were in and out of Danny North, possessing him only lightly, only enough to whisper reassurance to him. "This is safe," they were saying wordlessly. "What harm can it do? It's a dream. Nothing is real." Wad joined with his given-away gates in shouting their panic to the boy. Someone as strong-willed as Danny North, the Sudahites would never bother with. They could never own him. He would drive them out. What could they possibly gain by encouraging him to be intimate with this girl? And why was she there, uninvited? Wad came quickly to the conclusion that there was something in the girl, something that wanted very, very much to have her body intimate with Danny North's. Something that hungered for a clear pathway from one body to the other. It was Set, the dragon, making his first assault upon the greatest gatefather in the history of the world. And it was working, because the boy was an adolescent who was easy to arouse to passion, and he was deeply weary, and he was coming out of a sound sleep, and he knew the girl and did not fear her. All of it worked together so that even though Wad knew the boy felt the deep dread, the warning of Wad's gates inside him, he went ahead. He not only coupled with the girl, he consented when her voice asked him for permission to enter him. Fool. Fool. Not Danny. In his confusion, he was only as foolish as any boy would be. The fool was Wad. When Danny's exploration of Wad's memories had brought everything back to Wad with such clarity, it had not been half so clear to Danny North. Wad should have dropped everything then, should have used the Great Gate again to go to Danny North and explain everything, not in the vague way Danny would have learned it, but with the clarity of Wad's bright memory and of all that he knew beyond the information that came from Kawab during that desert conversation. "I should have prepared him for exactly this danger. But in my arrogance and solitude, I thought it was enough that I knew. Why would I think that? I'm in Westall. Danny's the one who was in danger, the one who needed to be alert to the way this sort of thing is done, and I betrayed him by my silence, my delay. Now, all is lost. Set has him, and can make as many great gates as he wants, 1,000 of them. He can flood Westall, the world of Mitherholm, with his Sudahites, and find a people totally unready to resist them. All the powers of the Mither Mages will be in their hands, compounded by as many passages between the worlds as they might need or want. Everything I tried to prevent has now taken place. So what if I delayed this day by 14 centuries? All that happened in the meantime was that Drowthers had created terrible weapons that now would be completely in the hands of the mages who had the power to take them and wield them, or induce the Drowther armies to use them. How long before those terrible machines made their way to Mitherholm as well? How long before they were used and Mitherholm destroyed along with Middlegard? Then Set would have his great triumph over Duat, having ruined both the other worlds. In that moment of despair, Wad was shocked to feel himself awash with a sense of power and connection. He had never felt this thing before, because he had never given his gates away before. It took a moment to realize that this was how it felt to have them given back. He didn't have them. They were still in Danny's heart hoard. But he owned them. They would obey him now, if they obeyed anybody. If Set, through Danny, tried to make them into gates, they would not become gates at all. They would simply return to Wad. Wad wasn't sure if Danny understood that. It was likely that Danny knew only that they were no longer Danny's to command, and therefore they were out of the reach of Set. The boy was braver than Wad had imagined. Danny must realize now that he had lost his battle with the enemy. But he was not giving up. Inside his own body, which Set must now control like a beast mage riding his heart bound, Danny North was still himself and was still capable of doing things that Set had no idea how to prevent. But since Danny did not have the power to free the gates he held captive in his heart hoard, this gift would only be a small limitation on Set. A futile gesture, really. Then Wad realized that it was not as futile as it seemed. There were things that Wad knew how to do that required him to have a huge aggregate of gates. And his own store of them had seemed huge indeed, until he met Danny North, whose natural heart hoard made Wad seem small and shallow. Wad might not have his gates with him. He might not be able to make them into gates. But they were his gates all the same, and if he reached out to swallow up another mage's gates, these captive gates of his would be part of his strength. If Wad was careful and clever, he might be able to find some way to resist Set after all. At least to slow him down. For one thing, Wad would have the power to swallow up the rebellious gates that were woven into the wild gate the Greek girl had moved out of Danny's control. Unfortunately, half of the outbound Great Gate and all of the inbound one was made up of Danny's own gates, and those would remain in place. Wad was still trying to think of possible uses for his newly restored power when he was overwhelmed by a force so strong his body could hardly cope with it. He fell to the ground, gasping for breath, whimpering with a feeling so strong that he could not tell if it was ecstasy or pain. In moments, though, he understood what had happened to him. Danny North had given Wad his gates. The seemingly infinite store of Danny North's own natural endowment was now utterly placed in perfect obedience to Wad and Wad alone. Danny was still connected to them. They were still part of his Ba, but they were almost as deeply connected to Wad. They were part of his power. Having his own gates returned to him and given Wad the scope to swallow the gates of any mage but Danny North, for Danny's strength was like the sun compared to Wad's otherwise impressive moon, but with Danny's gates as part of his own strength, Wad had power to swallow anything. He could still only make the 8 gates that Danny North had left to him in their original struggle. But any time he wanted to, he could change that. Though he had no way to make the gates that Danny held within his heart hoard, Set could force Danny to hold on to those, to prevent their being made. But the gates that were outside of Danny's body, the gates that he had made before Set took him, those were there for the taking. For with all of Danny's strength under his control, Wad had the power to swallow all of Danny's made gates. And so he did it. He swallowed first the wild gate that Hermia had moved, including all his former captives. They were in Wad's heart hoard once again, under his rigorous discipline. Their freedom had been short-lived, and they despaired and fell silent almost at once. Then Wad reached out, gate by gate, and swallowed the rest. But now, knowing that Danny North had made them all for a purpose, and Danny's friends relied on them, Wad remade them immediately, this time as gates of his own making, though the gates were Danny's. It was a subtle thing indeed, but with enormous consequences. If Set had understood his danger, he could have quickly gathered in all of Danny's made gates. But Set had only a little practice at possessing a gate mage. He would know only what was known to previous gate mages he had possessed, and there could not be many of those. He could not possibly know what was possible to a gate father of such magnificence as Danny North. Now, though, the gates were not of Danny's making, though they were his gates. Danny, under Set's control, could not gather in these gates. They would not obey him. And because his heart hoard was reduced to 0, Danny North couldn't even do what Hermia had done, move another mage's gate. Wad was astonished at the things that Danny North had done. Gates attached to amulets which his friends could use for quick escapes. gates that chained from place to place, which could be found only if you knew where the mouth was hidden. Wad understood now that Danny had provided highways for his drowther friends, to keep them safe if the families went after them. The boy had more love for ordinary people than Wad had ever heard of in a mage, more than Wad had ever shown, though he considered himself a drowther friend compared to most. The great gates were harder. He could not unmake them and then remake them as a whole. Instead, he spent hours carefully gathering each single strand, then remaking it by weaving it into the existing great gate, exactly where it had been before. It taxed all of Wad's power of concentration to hold the shape of it in place, but finally it was done. Even the great gates were now outside of Danny North's control, and therefore beyond the reach of Set to gather them back in. What irony, thought Wad. The outcome is almost identical to what it would have been if I had won our little battle when I first tried to eat the gates of Danny North. His heart hoard is full of gates, that's true. Most of his and most of mine. But he has no gate in either world that will respond to his commands. No gate that adds to his strength. He is as bereft of power as if I had stripped his gates away. Only the captive gates remain within him. He can't give them to me. But if Set tries to spin a great gate, it will be completely wild. And then, as Wad observed Danny from inside, he saw something that he wasn't sure he would have thought of, or, having thought, had the courage to act upon. The dragon was torturing Danny to try to get him to do what Danny no longer had the power to do, allow the dragon to control the making of Danny's gates. The game was simple enough. The dragon was threatening to kill Danny and move on if Danny didn't give him what was no longer Danny's to give. By the time the dragon understood how Danny had deceived him, he had done so much damage to Danny's body that Danny North would surely die unless he made a gate to pass himself through. At first, Set might have been content to let him die, as punishment for Danny's clever, stubborn disobedience. But then it must have occurred to Set that he was nowhere near any other person. Cut off from a human body, Set was weak again, unable to jump right in and control a person who had any willpower at all. If Danny's body died, it might take Set weeks or months to get control of a body that was worth controlling. Meanwhile, there was Danny's heart hoard. So many gates, and so many captives, too, including Wad's own gates. Even though Set hadn't the power to use them, if Danny died, then he would never have the power. As long as he remained in control of Danny's body, and Danny's body remained alive, then Set had a hope of persuading Danny to cooperate. And if that never happened, he could use Danny's body to bring him close enough to another person to make the jump smoothly and easily. He could always kill Danny later, he doubtless thought. And so he made one of the only gates remaining under Danny North's control, the captive gates. He made it and then moved it so that it passed over Danny's body, healing him. Danny North would not die. And then Danny did something Wad had not known was possible. He gave the captive gate to itself. The Ka that the gate had once been attached to was long dead, gone wherever the Ka's of dead gate mages went. But the Ba was still part of that self, wherever it was. And even though Danny could not find that Ka, he figured out that the Ba could find it, could always find its Ka. And so he gave the Ba to itself and through itself to its original maker, even though he was dead. The result was that the Ba was gone. Simply gone. Danny hadn't unmade the gate. Set would have known what that felt like, would have prevented Danny from doing it. But Set did not know what Danny was even doing when Danny performed the act of giving a gate. Because as far as Wad knew, he was the first mage ever to give a gate to another mage. If someone else had done it, Wad had never heard of it. And Danny had taken that new technique, had learned it, and then extended it to a use Wad would never have imagined. Danny's body was healed, and Set was in check.
His total supply of gates was limited to Wad's old captives, and now he knew that each time he made such a gate, he could use it once, but then it would be gone.
Danny North would set it free, would let it die and disappear. And though there were many hundreds of gates, that number would be exhausted very soon if Set made heavy use of them.
If space-time really had brought Danny North into the world as a giant prank, it was a good one. Because even though Danny North tried hard to be a decent man, he still had a prankster's heart, and he had chosen his victim well.
Set had thought he would be master, and he was. But Danny had taken the mastery out from under him, even though it meant that Danny would be left utterly empty when Set abandoned his body.
If Set let him live, Danny would be an empty gate mage, just like all the mages Wad had emptied through the years.
Wad knew well how rare it was for a mage to make such sacrifice. The usual thing, when a mage had been possessed, was for the mage to yield, to surrender quickly to the Sudahite's will, and then become its partner, obeying it but receiving the rewards of power ruthlessly applied.
Danny North could have taken that road.
Set would have used Danny's gates to become the most powerful mage in history, forcing all the other mages to bend to his will.
Truly, he would have been the great dragon then, master of two worlds, manipulator of humankind, mage and drowther alike. Mage of mage, god of gods, at least in the eyes of drowthers. Women, money, mastery of everyone. Anyone that Danny hated, he could have punished.
Set would have had no scruples about the taking of a life, of many lives.
But Danny had thrust all of that away, removed it from himself with no hope of getting any power back, so that Set would not have the use of that power, so that Westall was still safe, so that Wad's work was not undone.
Danny North, I admire you for your courage. I honor you for your cleverness. I pity you for your loss.
Because even if Set moves on to someone else, even if he doesn't kill you in revenge for having tricked him, do not think for a moment that I will ever give these gates back to you. I do not even want to be as noble as you. For a while, you were a greater mage than me. I am now, again, the greatest gate father in the world, and you are nothing. I will never give that up. I am the gate thief, and because of your nobility, the victory is mine.
Afterward. For those who wish for an afterword that is a continuation of the themes of the book, I must disappoint you. Instead, I want to talk a little about the practical difficulties that only the writers of fictional stories have any reason to care about. This book was 6 months late, but for good reason. If I were still the young writer of Songmaster and Treason, or even the not-so-young writer of Saints and Ender's Game, I would have delivered the book on time. It would also have been a very different kind of fiction. In the years since I wrote those novels, I've learned something about the structure of storytelling. I realized, as I began writing this book, in plenty of time to meet the original deadline, that I had the structure all wrong. I was planning to use this book to tell the story of the wars of the Mither Mages who had received the enhancement of their powers, thus melding the world of meddling gods shown in the Iliad and Odyssey with our modern kind of warfare. Then I realized that I couldn't tell that story well and only bring in the conflict with Set at the end. The danger from the Bellmage had to be at the heart of the story all the way through, or it would feel tacked on, an extra element when the real story was over. As I tell my writing students, you have to promise the story you are going to end. The ending of this series will require the resolution of the struggle with Set, just as the advent of newly powerful Mither Mages will supersede the wars and geopolitics of the Drowther world, so also the war with Set must supersede all other concerns in the minds of those few characters who know that it's going on. Once I faced that structural necessity, I realized that I was not ready to tell that story. All my thought and development had been with the lore of the ordinary Mither Mages, while the magery of Gate Mages and Man Mages remained nebulous and ill-formed in my mind. In order to tell this story, I needed to develop these more complicated rule sets. What is it exactly that a Man Mage does? Or, for that matter, a Gate Mage? In effect, I had to develop these mageries as if they were science fiction, exploring how and why they worked as they did, learning their powers and limitations. So instead of delivering a book on the 1st of May, I essentially started it over, always a depressing bit of news for an editor who trusted you to deliver when you said you would. But Beth Meacham, my editor for most of my career, also understands that it's better if I deliver the best book I'm capable of, rather than whatever book happens to be ready on the due date. Her patience is extraordinary, because the patience of editors is not passive. She has to fend off and placate marketing staff who are wondering just when or whether the promised book will appear. She has to make decisions about whether to go through the expensive and disappointing process of changing the publishing schedule. Fortunately, her employer and my publisher, Tom Doherty, shares the same literary values, that getting it right is more important than getting it now. My responsibility, then, is to be sure that any delay is worth it. I happened to be listening during this time to a course on ancient Egypt from the Great Courses series. When I heard the description of Thoth as being very much like Hermes and Mercury, including the power of healing and a connection with language, I realized that I could benefit greatly by adapting a version of Egyptian lore to my literalizing of Indo-European gods. Ka and Ba corresponded, or could be made to correspond, with the way I was already using in-self and out-self in the Mither Mages series. That allowed me to name the bell god I had taken from Semitic and biblical tradition. Set made a lovely, dangerous enemy. And as I invented more and more of the lore surrounding him, tying him to the dragon in the Book of Revelation, the workings of man magic became something rich and fascinating, and very close to what I had already developed for gate magic. In other words, they made a consistent whole, and one that I believe corresponds with the real world in significant metaphorical ways. Having invented the world I needed, I then had to find a way to make it clear to readers. What made it especially difficult was my determination that all the communication between Ka and Ba had to be on a pre- or subverbal level. We don't talk to our own minds and bodies in language, and so when I had Wad Loki's Ba trying to share his memories with Danny North's Ka, I had to put it on a non-verbal level. Yet books are written in words. Finding a means of representing non-speech in speech was daunting. I hope that for most readers, I succeeded. As I learned more about man-mages, the character of Annonawe began to grow. I began this novel with no idea that Annonawe would be important in it. She insisted on growing into something important, she and her sons, and so they will be major figures in the third and final volume. Another problem was to keep from getting so caught up in the lore of magery that I lost track of the real world, our world, and Danny's place in it. It was very important to me that his friends become memorable individuals, and that Danny fall in love in a serious way. These high school students should not be merely Danny's foils, people he can talk to in order for us to learn what he's thinking. In this novel, they represent us, the Drowthers, ordinary people who are in awe of the gods, if we believe in them, and I have met few people who didn't have some conception of a god, whether they would apply that title to it or not. How would these teenagers respond to having the new kid turn out to be the equivalent of Hermes and Mercury and Loki and Thoth? One theme that runs through mythology is the amazing fecundity of the gods. The world seems half-populated by their bastards. While a few of these are rapes in the old sense of carrying off the human female, whether the sex turns out to be consensual or not, it's also a fact of human life that there are certain women who are irresistibly drawn to powerful males. As Henry Kissinger pointed out, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. This is not true for all women or for all powerful people. But Danny North would not have to look like a young George Clooney or Robert Redford in order to attract the notice, let alone the eager desire, of a certain contingent of young women. His power, his intelligence, and I must add, his innate goodness, would make him desirable to many girls, for reasons as various as the girls themselves. The result was that my original outline for this book is now an amusing cast-off. That which survives from it will be in the third volume, while most of what's valuable in this book was not in the outline. Stories are invented as you go along if you're writing them properly, and that means that characters and situations that come out of nowhere can blossom into productive mines that bring out tramloads of metal-rich ore. My skill as a refiner is a different issue, but I think the ore I smelted to make this book is of a much finer metal than what I originally planned. How can we tell, though? The earlier version was never written, not a word of it. It existed in my head, so I think of it as real. But no graduate student will ever pore over the differences between drafts, because the book you just read is the only draft that actually hit the paper. How do you unfold the tale in an order which will be clear and interesting to readers who obviously begin the book knowing almost nothing about the story, and must end it understanding all? I regard it as the essence of good structure, that all the key information will have been presented earlier in the book, so when you move through the climactic scenes at the end, everything is already clear to the reader, because it was so well explained earlier on. This means that the exposition is front-loaded. But readers won't tolerate, nor should they, a story that begins with nothing but exposition. The device that works best is for the point of view character to know little more than the reader does. Thus, when the viewpoint character learns it, so does the reader. But what if the viewpoint character's learning is also vague and highly subjective? And how much information is too much for a given scene? Boredom and inclarity are the ways to drive readers out of a book, to make them close it and never open it again. The goal, then, is to provide the light with enough sweetness at every stage that the reader will stay with you, learning constantly but also getting the rewards of a good story along the way. This is not a trick. Here are the good bits, so you'll keep reading the boring bits. On the contrary, the good bits require the explanations, but the explanations themselves need to be part of the action, so that it never feels as if the story has stopped cold while the reader is brought up to speed. This is such a delicate dance that most writers fail at it most of the time. And most of us realize that we will never find the perfect way to tell a story. It's likely that there is no such thing. We just keep dancing as fast as we can, hoping to take you far enough into the workings of the world that when you move from one event to the next in the story, you always know where you are and what's happening, and you always understand just what is at stake. This is hard enough with fiction that takes place in the real world. When the world itself must also be explained, the expository burden becomes dreadfully heavy. The result is that some writers skimp on world development, coasting along by borrowing the stereotypes of earlier writers in the field. Others include every detail of their world creation, whether it's relevant to the plot or not, as if they wanted to make all their readers memorize the Silmarillion before they were worthy to read Lord of the Rings. This is a long way of saying that the better your world creation, the heavier the expository burden. And sometimes, your world creation is so deep and rich that the actual story never measures up to it. In the effort to create a story that does measure up, sometimes you're late. But that does not imply that being late will make your story better. My most popular book was written in a single swath, more quickly than I could have imagined possible. This does not imply that moving quickly through a tale will make it better either. Each story poses its own unique set of problems. It merely happens that the problems I had to solve in order to tell this story were some of the hardest, creatively and technically, that I've ever faced in my writing career. That's the problem with growing older and more experienced. Decisions that would have been good enough when I was 30 now seem like cheap shortcuts to me at 61. I know how to write better than I did before, but knowing better usually means that I have to work harder, invent more, and find solutions to ever more difficult expository problems. This is why writers never retire. If we're doing our job right, we're always just figuring out how this thing is done. We're always novice writers, flailing about to find some kind of solid ground for moving forward.
This concludes the reading of The Gate Thief by Orson Scott Card. Copyright 2013 by Orson Scott Card. This book was read by Emily Rankin and Stefan Rudnicki, with the afterword read by Orson Scott Card. This unabridged recording